Before we go any further, just for emphasis, again, let's go over that definition of persistence. And again, ask yourself this question, do I fit the mold of being a persistent person according to this definition? And if so, what can I do to maintain my persistence? And if not, what can I do to improve? Persistence can be defined as never giving up despite dislike, disapproval, or difficulties. It also means to endure despite obstacles. Some other words or synonyms that have like meaning are steady, lasting, fixed, and immovable. Well, how did you do? Well, as we did before, let's go over the opposite also, or the antonym of persistence. Wavering, unsure, hesitant, vacillating, and easily worn down. Well, how you doing so far? You holding up? You know, another key that all really persistent people have in common is that they all seem to be like little detectives. They're always snooping and rummaging for more knowledge and clues that can assist them to get over that next hurdle. Now, here's something that I learned when it comes to contacting people on the phone that were normally very difficult to get a hold of, namely TV producers and reporters. Now, if my company has an idea, we make it a point to pitch it directly to the right person, those involved in making the decision as to who allows something to be aired on their show. So here's a scenario. My staff want to get me on a particular news segment. The rule of thumb is to usually fax the information or the press release to the assignment editor or assignment desk. Now, if they like the story, they'll assign it to someone or a reporter, obviously, to report on it. At this point, don't hold your breath for them to call you back because they usually don't. Now, we found that if we can contact the reporter directly and contact them first and then pitch the idea and they happen to like it, it greatly increases our odds of getting that story on the air. So the trick here is, how do you contact them personally? Well, a little persistence helps us figure it out. The normal route is to call the station's telephone number and they will transfer you to the reporter's voicemail. Now, you and 100 other people are in the voicemail box. Of course, that's going to obviously decrease your odds of getting a return phone call. So here's how we do it. Again, this is all bred or comes from a persistent attitude. Now, I learned that most TV stations, they pack all the producers and reporters in a large room with little cubicles. That knowledge was the key to getting in touch with the producers or reporters. How? Well, now when I call the station, I won't ask the switchboard for the operator. I would ask for the news desk or the assignment desk or editor. And by the way, at most TV stations, the news desk is monitored by a real person 24 hours a day. So then, I get to the news desk, someone picks up and says, "News department, may I help you?" And I simply say, "Yeah, could you see if so-and-so is around?" 9 times out of 10, you'll hear them yell, "Hey, so-and-so there, oh, there she is, hey, hold on a second, I'll transfer you now." And I get right through. We have personally contacted small-time local TV reporters this way, up to national TV shows. Our persistent attitude enables us to focus on looking for new creative ways to get our goals accomplished. I'm always looking for new clues and new ways to get the job done. People who are not prone to being persistent don't come up with neat ways to get the job done. I personally find it fun and really challenging to find quick ways to get a hold of people that I need to, especially when others have tried and tried and they say they can't. Now, another area that I find is very productive and beneficial in aiding ourselves to be persistent is the way we ask ourselves questions when we are confronted with obstacles. Here's a typical example. Let's say we're on a journey of success and something major happens in a negative way. After something like that happens, here's the most common question I hear. What am I going to do now? The way it's said sounds like we've given up. Notice I said the way it's said sounds like we've given up. The question in itself is okay, but how we said it, that will determine whether we force our brains to help us to keep going forward or to quit. So instead of saying, "What am I going to do now?" it should be, "What am I going to do now?" People who are afraid of failing, they have a hard time saying, "What am I going to do now?" Because saying it this way means that they're going to have to force themselves to come up with ways to get things done. And they might not really want to do that, because if they have to force themselves to find out how to get some answers, that answer might move them to action, which in turn could cause them to fail. So then how would a person condition themselves to adopt this type of right attitude, this get right back up attitude? Many have mastered the belief that everything happens for a reason. I'm sure you've heard that one before. One of the only ways to really believe that is to unfortunately have a past record of failures or obstacles, then we don't let them stop us and realize that it still worked out and may be better than you expected. It's easy to lose control and get very discouraged when a major problem arises. Now, for me, in most cases, I've come to appreciate that when things don't go as planned and I have to take another route, I usually end up with a better deal or result when it's all said and done. So make it a goal to try to truly convince yourself of that the next time your plans don't go or turn out as well as you expected. Now, I'll share with you how you can develop this ability. You remember earlier in this program, we talked about creating a belief and then believing it. We specifically referred to the belief something will come up. Now, recall how we did that. First, we wrote down the problem that led to feeling that nothing would or could come up. Second, we wrote the belief something will come up. And last, when something did come up, we associated it as good and we wrote it down. I encouraged you to make as many sheets with this information as possible. Remember why? So it could consciously help you develop a pattern. A pattern of every time you said something will come up, it did. How do you know? You've got proof. Here it is in all these pieces of paper. So let's use the same principle with something better will come out of this problem or challenge. I think you'll agree if a person adopts this type of attitude, they're going to keep going forward. Now, we do this exercise just like we did the other. Number one, you first write down the problem. Second, write down the belief. Something good or better will come out of this problem. And third, as long as you keep going forward, wait, and I use that term loosely, wait for something good to happen and then write it down. Keep doing that over and over and page after page, and I can promise you if you don't believe that something good or better comes out of these problems, you will after effectively following through on these exercises. Try it. I think you'll like it. Now, I wish to share with you what I feel is one of the most powerful words a persistent person knows. It's personally on my favorite word list in the dictionary. It's the word ask. It never hurts to ask, ask, ask. Of course, a person who is not afraid to ask is one who opens himself up for a lot of no's. Usually the roads to yes starts with a road of no's and lots of them. You know, you never know what's behind that door until you ask. Not knock on it, but open it. Doors galore will be open to those who ask. And you've heard this before. What's the worst thing that could happen? You can get a what? You can get a no. Oh well. Something else that can prevent us from being really persistent is the fact that we can let our negative imagination run wild. You know, it's human tendency to allow our imagination to run wild and make problems worse than they really are. In other words, making mountains out of molehills. You know, with regards to fears, our tendency is to magnify the fear in our mind and make it worse than it really is. This really seems to be the case when we're just a little down or maybe our plans aren't working the way we anticipated. At this point, if we're not careful, we can start a negative momentum to destruction. The pressure of a plan not working out can be very stressful and it can cause us to throw in the towel. Now, if we're not careful, our minds will run away from us. Self-doubt can creep in, which in turn prevents us from getting up and trying again. Sometimes you might picture your failure worse than it really is. Maybe you see yourself losing everything. Now, as the mind continues to run along that route, you begin to feel even worse. Now, I know I used to do a lot of that. When things got really bad, the first thing that would come to my mind is, oh no, I'm going to have to go bankrupt. And when I started this business, I came very close to it at least two times. My mind would play havoc on me. We must not let our negative imagination run wild in us. We've got to stay focused and take control. You know, our minds seem to get away from us when we begin to perceive that we have or are failing. Not too long ago, I was watching a TV program that dealt with transplants of organs. It was very interesting the comment that one doctor made about their view on failure. And of course, in their case, unfortunately, failure is the loss of a life. But here's what he said. We really don't learn much from our successes. He said it's the failures that really teach us something. How interesting. It was obvious to me that he really meant that. I think it's a great attitude for all of us to adopt. We really do learn from our past mistakes if we are willing to keep going forward. But if we refuse, then it can't be said that we can truly learn from our failures or mistakes. You know, it reminds me of the gentleman who was 80 years old and someone asks him, hey, if you had to do it all over again, would you make the same mistakes? And here's his comment. He said, absolutely, but I would make them a lot sooner. What a great attitude. Why would he care to make his same mistakes a lot sooner? Because he would learn things a lot quicker. In other words, it would make him wiser beyond his years. So the moral of the story is, don't be afraid to make mistakes. Well, there's more. Have you ever stopped to think about how much we accomplish before we're ready to go on a vacation? Imagine for a moment that you're leaving on a four-day vacation, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Do you think it's humanly possible to accomplish 5 days worth of work, Monday through Friday, in 3 days so you'll be ready for that vacation? I think so. I know I would. Well, now let's spend some time analyzing all that we would do in preparation for that little vacation. Number one, I think perhaps the first thing that we do is get out a pen and paper. In fact, people who normally don't take notes down or have a to-do list, they'll usually do this right before a vacation if they've got to pack a lot of things in. Now, we know that if we're going to have to accomplish 5 days worth of work in 3 days, we have to be very organized. We also know the need to prioritize things on our list is going to be very, very important. So by using a to-do list, it's going to help us stay focused. If we know that we have to leave for 4 days, we have to stay focused so we can make that trip effectively. So then if we care to accomplish 5 days worth of work in 3 days on a regular basis, we need to do the same thing in our lives every day. Now, years ago, there was a gentleman who used to assist me in my business, and he would often ask me, "Gary, what's the rush?" I didn't spend much time to chit-chat with him about nothing. I've always been a firm believer that if I can do 5 days worth of work in 3 days, I'm going to get to point B a lot quicker. And if I'm doing 5 days worth of work in 3 days, I'm also doing 5 years worth of work in 3 years. Now, I like the sound of that. I'm also a firm believer that if I'm going to be working, I should be working. If I'm at my office for 8 hours and I only do 4 hours worth of work, that's really a total waste. It would make more sense for me mentally or psychologically, if you will, if I came into my office only for 4 hours, worked those 4 hours, and then goofed off for the other four. It's amazing how focused we become and how much work we can accomplish when we take a vacation in our minds every day. The next thing that we probably do in order to accomplish everything that we have to is that we might consider getting up a little earlier than normal and going to bed a little later than normal. Some people don't like to give up their sleep, and I don't blame them, but sometimes we might have to. The next thing is, what about getting rid of non-essentials? You know, one of the biggest is the watching of television. You know, it's been estimated that the average adult views anywhere from 4 to 6 hours of TV a day. What a waste. I mean, if you stop to multiply that for a week or a month or a year, that's a lot of wasted time down the drain. Now, I would recommend that you make your list of areas in your life that you waste time in. And after making that list, make it a goal to work on improving in those specific areas. You will find that life will be so much more rewarding and so much more fulfilling if you master your time instead of your time mastering you. Don't waste time on trivial things. And if you do, you won't be able to make it on that vacation on Thursday. Now, getting organized would also help us if we're going to try to accomplish 5 days worth of work in three. It also helps us if we want to be persistent in reaching our goals. We know right where we are if we happen to get off track. Now, I'll share with you something that helps me stay focused and organized. At the end of each workday, I write down what I need to accomplish for the next day. And then before I go to bed, I go over that list. This will also be the determining factor as to when I will need to get up and get to the office. So throughout the day, I also look over my schedule constantly on a regular basis. This way I know what needs to be done now, what needs to be done later, tomorrow, and the rest of the week. Now I find for me personally, if I take a trip in my mind, I will work very hard to get things done. The quicker you get the job done, the quicker you're able to get the next one going. And I seem to move faster with a sense of urgency. You know, the words sense of urgency are important ones. This involves a state of mind. You'll notice that when you work at something with a sense of urgency, you probably feel different. You move more swiftly. You stay more targeted. Try to learn how to adopt that state of mind on a regular basis. It's basically the state of mind that you will unconsciously adopt if you really are going on a vacation Thursday through Sunday and you have to do 5 days worth of work in 3 days. The next time you have to shorten your workday for whatever reason and you have a lot of things to do to cram into that short day, observe your every move. Write down all the things you do in comparison to things that you don't do when you really don't have to get a lot of things done right away. Then try to mimic that attitude on a consistent basis. You will be pleasantly surprised how much you can accomplish no matter what gets in your way, and nothing will slow you down. Another observation that I've made with those who are really persistent is that they don't blame others for their failures. Persistent people take blame for their own actions, and if we have a tendency to blame others, it makes it too easy to quit and tire out. This is a very important point to remember. Common sense should tell us that any time we work toward reaching our goals, that we're going to meet with challenges. And I can promise you, the bigger the goal, the bigger the obstacle. You can pretty well count on that. Now imagine the disadvantage we would be at if every time we ran into a problem, we blamed it on someone else or we blamed it on the economy or whatever. Many people spend more time blaming their failures on everybody else when they should have taken that time to fix the problem. I feel that it's very important that we not be so overly concerned as to who is right or wrong. The bottom line is to solve the problem so that we can move on and get closer to reaching our goals. You know, truly persistent people usually don't have a chip on their shoulders either. People with chips on their shoulders have a strong tendency to blame other people for their own mistakes, and they find it very difficult to maintain a persistent attitude. Take full responsibility for your actions. It's the right thing to do. You know, here's another sure way to assist you in keeping that persistent attitude. Take time to read or listen to stories about people who have failed but refused to give up. I know for me that is very refreshing. I don't know about you, but more times than not, I used to feel that I was the only one out there that was going through the pain of trying to keep going. It's a very lonely feeling, especially if you don't know too many other people like yourself that have that never quit type attitude. My situation got so bad that I hardly could find a few people that I could actually confide in. Most of them would just say, hey, why don't you just declare bankruptcy, or don't you think you should just get a 9-to-5 job? That's not what I wanted to hear, even though they may have been very right, or I probably felt that way. So invest some time, go to the library, do whatever it takes to find some real success stories. There are tons of them. Henry Ford, Walt Disney, big name people, and the little people. If you feel drained because everywhere you seem to turn, you run into a dead end and the results aren't coming as quick as you would like them to, read about what others have gone through to get their results. It's nice to know that you're not the only one out there who's going through the same thing. I've invested some of my own time and I've done a little bit of homework of some very successful companies and their owners that had very difficult times starting their business. You'll realize most of the names, if not all of them. The name is Borden. Yes, that's right, Borden Dairy Products. What an interesting man Gale Borden was. This man was really persistent. He was an inventor. One of his first inventions was what was called the Terraqueous Wagon. He was well ahead of his time. The wagon was designed to be equally effective on the sea as it was to be on the land. Now, once it hit the water, the sails would go up, and it even had a little rudder to steer it. You may have never heard about this. Why? Because it was a total flop. He took some of the townsmen for a little ride, and they all nearly drowned. Failure number one. How embarrassing. You'll get a kick out of his next invention. It was his plan to freeze out disease. He came up with this plan after his wife had died during the yellow fever outbreak in the mid-1800s. He believed that the hot weather was really the culprit to spreading diseases. He figured that if he could build a humongous refrigerated building, people could spend the hot summer months in it protected from the sun and the heat and the disease. How absurd! Unfortunately for him, the locals thought the same. You guessed it, failure number two. Is something starting to come together here? I'll give you a hint. Borden refrigerator. Now he's got this huge refrigerated system that's wasting away. Or is it? No, not dairy, not yet. He had to fail some more. He converted the building into a food plant and produced his next invention, the flat meat biscuit. Now, he got some bites on that one. Get it, bites? Oh, well. At least he won an award for it in England. On his trip back from England to New York, tragedy struck. 4 children died on the ship as a result from drinking bad milk. In those days, the milk wasn't kept cold, so it easily got contaminated. In fact, to keep the milk as fresh as possible, they even had cows on the ship. Bothered by the deaths of these young children, Borden was determined to solve the problem. How? Remember that overgrown refrigerator? Well, you know the rest of the story, or do you? He made the milk safer, but went out of business within 1 year. He learned from his mistakes. He refused to give up. He refocused, got more financing, and now you know the rest of the story. Wasn't that interesting? This is also a part that I found that was also very interesting. It is the inscription on his tomb, and it said, "I tried and failed. I tried again and succeeded." I like that. Then there was a man by the name of Bill Lear. He too was an inventor, and a man whose invention that I personally have an obsession with, the Learjet. Bill Lear was an 8th grade dropout from Hannibal, Missouri. His passion for inventing was discovered early in his life. Now, he came from a poor family, and what was very frustrating for Bill was that every time he started to work on one of his ideas, many times he would quit halfway. Not because he was a quitter, but because he never had enough money to finish his projects. Now, I think a lot of people can relate to that. He was once interviewed by someone and was quoted saying, "I resolved first to make enough money so I'd never stop from finishing anything." He worked very hard to make that a reality, but it didn't happen overnight. He had an idea of putting radios in automobiles. Now, while working under the Motorola name, he was successful in accomplishing this goal. He slowly began to acquire his wealth. Motorola paid him royalties for his invention, and he was on his way to the next level. Now, soon after, he became heavily involved in aviation. Now, I knew there was a reason why I liked this man so much, and this was early in the 1930s. Aviation at that time obviously was really in its infancy, and so was navigation. But he put his genius mind to the test and designed a great navigational system that brought him literally millions of dollars. He was now hitting financial success. He also designed an automatic pilot that airplanes needed, and that also did well. He was now, again, making millions of dollars, and he didn't stop there. He had an idea. He wanted to design a corporate jet that executives could use to travel in. Now, this would be a major, major project for his company. He proposed the idea to all of his corporate bigwigs, and they loved it. No, not really. They thought it stunk and wouldn't budge on assisting him with his idea. So what did he do? He refused to give up. He really went overboard to keep his jet dream alive. He sold all of his shares in his own company and formed Learjet Incorporated. Now, that took a lot of guts. This man believed he was a go-getter, not to mention very, very persistent. And $8 million later, he fulfilled his dream. He truly achieved what was referred to as the impossible. So his new jet could fly at nearly Mach speeds, and it could climb at a staggering rate of 8,000 feet per minute and level out at altitudes of over 40,000 feet. And in his first year, he reached sales of over $50 million. And this was back in the 60s. Now, I remember one of my Learjet instructors telling me that the second jet, it may have been the first, but it was either the first or the second jet he actually designed, it crashed. Now, you'd think, oh no, it's over with now. But because it crashed and everybody in the jet survived, it proved the safety of the aircraft, which ended up increasing his sales again. Not too shabby for a man who had a dream and refused to give up despite the rejection that he received from his own peers. He refused to be denied and will go down in aviation history for a long, long time. You know, one advantage that I've observed with people who refuse to give up is that they many times don't know what they're going to be successful in doing. Both Lear and Borden are typical examples of that. Borden didn't start out in dairy. One invention after another failed. And because he refused to give up, it led him to another, and so on and so on. Recall it was the death of his wife that led him to the refrigerator idea, that led him to winning an award that took him to England, which led him to being a passenger on a ship to New York, where he observed the death of those kids due to the contaminated milk, which led him to the Borden Empire of today. Interesting how things turn out. If he would have decided to give up on his car, boat, crazy idea thing here, would he have attained the level of success that he did? Probably not. I have learned beyond the shadow of a doubt that if you keep going, doors will be open to you, doors that you never imagined. And I'm speaking from experience on that one. Bill Lear was no different. He knew it took money to complete his inventions, and he worked to get to the level where he could afford to follow through on his ideas. If he decided to give up, I personally wouldn't enjoy the passion that I have for flying Learjet. Thanks, Bill. Ever chewed gum before? If you answered yes, you've probably put money in this man's pocket. His name is William Wrigley Jr. This is another great example of someone who didn't set out to invent or sell chewing gum. The idea literally fell in his lap, and he saw it as an opportunity, and it's been history ever since. So let me share with you some of this interesting history. Now, I don't know about you, but hearing stories like this really motivates me personally to keep pressing forward no matter what the obstacle is, and I hope you're getting the same feeling. Bill Wrigley Jr. was a very rambunctious kid. He was always getting into trouble, and he was regularly kicked out of school. His parents couldn't control him. They tried everything. Now, listen to this. As a teenager, he used to live in the streets with the other wanderers and homeless people. Can you imagine? He soon got tired of that lifestyle and decided to finally go back home. Now, Dad had something more in store for him than just a belt. He sentenced him to hard labor at the family's soap manufacturing plant. Now, sometime after that, his father had him selling the soap, and that's where it all began. Notice that I said started selling soap. Nothing yet about chewing gum. He quickly realized that he had a real skill for selling, so he sold more and more and more. He exhibited the incredible drive that it took to be a real professional salesperson just on his first call. He refused to take no for an answer. You're going to love this part. He followed his first client around for 2 hours. That's right, 2 hours before they finally gave in and they made a purchase. And it didn't stop there. This whiz kid of a salesman literally set up camp and slept outside for a night on a man's doorstep to convince him to buy. He was patient, polite, but refused to give up. That's exactly the type of attitude that we need to develop if we are serious about our goals. Bill wanted to go beyond just selling soap. He added more products. One was baking powder. Not only was he a great salesman, but he was also a genius at marketing. Now, as a way of encouraging his clients to purchase his product, he came up with a marketing plan. He would include, here we go, 2 free what? Sticks of gum with every package of baking powder. Here is where it gets really interesting. He was getting a lot of interest from people who bought the baking powder, but not for the powder. They wanted the gum. He was so convinced that people liked the gum, he quit selling everything except the what? You know, except the gum. Wrigley's Chewing Gum began. Wow, pretty cool, isn't it? So he set out to conquer the chewing gum world, and conquer he did. Now, thanks to his marketing skills, here's what he came up with. He had to come up with a way to encourage or persuade grocery store owners to carry his products. So for those store owners who were willing to purchase $15 worth of gum, he would give them a pair of scales. Now, he wouldn't make much money on the transaction up front due to, obviously, the cost of the scales, but he knew that if he could only get the gum in the store, people would keep coming back for more. It was a long-term plan that worked. He would also give away coffee makers, cash registers, and other useful items that the stores could use. It worked. Sales increased and increased, and he still didn't stop. Now listen to this. In 1915, he acquired the entire mailing list of the United States. 1.5 million households. He mailed 4 sticks of free gum to each one. Imagine the cost of that. 4 years later, he did it again. This time, he mailed 7 million pieces. He put money into his advertising and marketing, and it paid off. He spent a whopping $100 million on advertising alone. Not too bad for a kid who was kicked out of school. Imagine what he would have said if you were to tell him while he was a teenager on the streets that he would be a multimillionaire selling chewing gum. He would have probably laughed in your face as he rudely smacked the gum as he was talking to you. You know, this is another great example of someone who was successful because he refused to give up. His desire to keep going forward helped fertilize his drive. And recall earlier in this program that I talked about the importance of watching who you hang around with. Make it a point to be with people who support and believe in you when at all possible. We all know what it feels like when we're not supported and when people think our ideas are no good. Well, that was a similar situation for a man by the name of Dr. Thomas Welch. I'm sure you've heard that last name. Dr. Thomas Welch was a dentist in Vineland, New Jersey. In fact, some of his patients would pay for his dental work with bushels of, yeah, you guessed it, of grapes. Now, being a Methodist, he was strongly against the use of alcohol, but experimented with a way to make not wine with the grapes, but Dr. Welch's unfermented wine. He figured the local churches would at least buy his unfermented wine. He thought it would be great for the communion ceremony instead of the real wine. Well, that didn't go over well at all. No sell there. The fact that he led the prohibition against alcohol didn't help him either. He tried to convince people that this juice was the alternative. Now, are you ready for his overnight success? Well, there really wasn't any for Tom. In fact, 20 years after his non-alcoholic drink debuted, his sales were dismal. Someone else in the family thought they could make a go at this unfermented wine. It was Thomas's son, Charles. He thought it had market value and borrowed $5,000 from Dad. Now, he started producing the beverage in large quantities and he started hitting the road. But first, something had to change. It was the name. Dr. Welch's unfermented wine just didn't get it. So Charles switched the name to the now famous Welch's Grape Juice. And we all know the rest of the story. Charles Welch, like Bill Wrigley, knew the importance of marketing. He gave away his juice. He figured if you could get a drink of it, you'd want to buy more of it, and it worked. Unfortunately, his dad, Thomas, well, he never got to see his grapes grow into the empire it is today. Welch died in 1903, and his son continued marketing and selling the juice thereafter. You know, I think an important tool to ponder while listening to these stories is that none of these people were overnight successes. It took years. They were in it for the long run. Keep that in mind for yourself. Find what you want to do and be like a stamp. Stick to one thing. Make it work before you decide to venture off into other fields. You know, perhaps you've heard the saying, when life gives you a lemon, turn it into lemonade. Well, that's exactly what Joyce Hall, the backbone of the famous Hallmark greeting cards, and his brother Rolly did. In the early 1900s, Joyce and his brother Rolly were making a positive go in the greeting card business. Now, Valentine's was on the way, and orders were really getting filled. At this particular time in their business, they were getting very close to paying off their debt of nearly $20,000. Now, that may not sound like a tremendous amount of money, but in the early 1900s, $20,000 could really go a very, very long way. Now, imagine this. Business is doing well. You've got thousands of cards going out and thousands more to go. The next holiday order of cards will help you in your quest to become debt-free, and then wham! A fire starts in your plant and destroys your entire inventory. How discouraging that must have been for the Halls. They had to work for so many years to get to this level. The Halls were a very poor family before they started their card business, and life was very difficult for them. They virtually grew up without a father, and they had to care for their health-ridden mother. But the Hall brothers stuck to their guns, and they didn't give up. About 5 years later, not 5 days, not 5 weeks, not 5 months, but about 5 years later, they had rebuilt that little empire to include over 100 employees. You know, Joyce Hall had a mission for his Hallmark cards. He set out to market his cards to be a brand name, not just on a local level, but a national one, thus penning the slogan, "When you care to send the very best." Today, Hallmark is synonymous with quality, and one of Joyce's keys to his success was that he was a hands-on man. Here's what I mean by that. He constantly stayed involved with his company. You see, I hear a lot of people tell me, oh, when my company gets big or I make this much money, I'm going to have somebody else run it because I deserve it, and I'm going to kick back and relax. Well, great, maybe you do deserve it. Maybe you do deserve to kick back and relax. But I can relate to you story after story of many people who went into business for themselves, became very successful, pulled themselves out of the picture, put others in charge, and lost their shirts. Joyce Hall personally approved every card printed by Hallmark up until his retirement. That's a hands-on approach, and it works. He could have gotten lazy and certainly had enough money to relax, but he knew what customers wanted, and he delivered. Well, you ever heard of the man by the name of Adnan Khashoggi? At one time, he was the wealthiest man in the world. Adnan was originally from Saudi Arabia, and this guy was a master at getting to the next level and doing it quickly. His goal in business was to get people to come to him instead of having him go to them. But before I get to that, let me tell you a little bit more about Adnan Khashoggi. Now, Khashoggi came to the United States for his college education. See, the Saudi Arabian government actually gives overseas students a modest living allowance, and at that time, it was $200 a month. So students that came to the United States after Khashoggi, they were amazed at his lifestyle because they couldn't live like him, and they received the same $200 a month. Khashoggi moved from the college dorms to a hotel. He hired a secretary to do his schoolwork, and he always picked up the tab when he ate out with his friends. Of course, they wanted to hang around him even more. He created an impression of great wealth. Now, of course, most people in the United States have Saudi Arabians, stereotyped as being, wealthy, right? Well, one day, He was treating his friend to dinner at the hotel that he was staying, and he ran out of money, so he asked his friend for $5. That $5 was his friend's last $5. Now, keep in mind that Khashoggi had nothing financially at this point. So after receiving the $5 from his friend, he went to the hotel desk clerk and asked to buy a pack of cigarettes. Now, back in the 50s, a pack of cigarettes was about 25 cents, 50 cents, or even less. So after the clerk handed him the cigarettes, he told the clerk to keep the change. Now, his friend was not happy with that. Khashoggi explained to his friend that his hotel bill was due the next day, and he didn't have the money to pay it. So he figured that if he left a $5 tip, the clerk would assume that he was loaded with money, and the hotel would bill him for his room. Yes, he created the impression of wealth. A $5 tip for someone having just handing you a pack of cigarettes to this day would be considered a lot of money for a tip. His idea worked. Soon he moved into a rented house. He allowed his friends to stay with him under one condition. They would serve him. One would be his butler, another the gardener, and the list went on. His friends really didn't mind it because they all were part of his lavish parties. They rode his wave to success.